We have with us live in the studios once again, never ceases to amaze me, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Hello.
You are easily amazed, aren't you?
I am.
We just have entirely too much fun before the microphones come on. So, we're just going to have to figure out this dynamic of like pretending the microphones aren't on, and then maybe other people could have some fun also.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. Yeah. I think people have plenty of fun listening to us.
I don't know. I have this sense of somebody lying in bed on a Saturday morning, and they've had a nice relaxing morning. Maybe they have a cup of tea or something, and then suddenly for 30 minutes they get bombarded with all the icky things going on in the world, and then the rest of their whole day is ruined.
You're assuming that people aren't listening to the programs ahead of us.
Oh, so we're actually more hopeful than the programs ahead of us are. This is sort of the light at the end of the tunnel, or people realize that they have only a half hour before the really good music comes on, and then that's how.
All right.
Anyway.
So
how are you, Mike? We never ask how you are.
You never do. I'm doing okay. I'm a little tired because I had new neighbors that are a bit younger and like to party all night long, and they party till about 4 this morning, which is about 15 minutes before I have to get up to come in here. So anyway,
Greg Scott, who's a local folk singer, has a record that he had actually a number of years ago called something like The Neighbors Upstairs, and it's this hilarious song about people who like to move furniture at 2 in the morning and play their music really loud. And it's really quite wonderful for anybody who's ever lived in that kind of situation.
Well, let's jump into things because we got a ton to cover in a very short period of time. FCC, the big day is coming up on Monday when they turn over the reins, apparently, to the big corporations, those that they haven't already turned over.
Yeah, KEXP by this time next week will be a service of Clear Channel Communications, as will the entire radio dial in Seattle and in every other city in America.
I thought we were going to be part of the Fox network.
Well, actually, they're going to do a timeshare kind of thing. It's like condos in Hawaii.
Oh, I'm going to be part of the Fox network, and you're going to be part of Clear Channel. I see.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think you would do really well as the conservative commentator. That would be a lot of fun.
Be right there with Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, we
call
joy.
It the Maria factor. I like that. The FCC has set itself a deadline of tomorrow to
day after tomorrow.
I'm sorry.
Monday.
God, the weekend goes so much faster when you skip a day. The day after tomorrow to issue its edict from the mountaintop as to how it will deregulate, as though that's the thing that we all urgently need, broadcast media. They undertook a comprehensive review of media ownership regulations last fall. FCC chairperson Michael Powell, Coleman's son, and he has in the past been the FCC commissioner, one of five, and then President Bush named him chairman when the Republicans came in. And the way it works is that there are five FCC commissioners, and whoever's in the White House, that party has three of the commissioners. So the Republicans now have the majority of three, and then Democrats fill two seats. The Democrats are both opposed to Michael Powell's initiative, which called into question really all of the remaining restrictions on who can own how many broadcasts, that is, over-the-air television and radio stations, whether networks can buy other networks, how many stations a network can own, and whether newspapers and radios and TV stations can be jointly owned by the same corporation in the same market. There are a handful.
Called cross-ownership.
Yes, called cross-ownership. There are a handful around the country who were grandfathered because that actually didn't become a regulation until, I think, 1970. But by and large, it has been not allowed so that, for example, Hearst, which owns TV and radio stations in a lot of other cities, cannot own them in Seattle right now because it also owns the PI for the time being. What this threatens to do if Michael Powell has his way and puts forward an unencumbered version of his deregulation is to consolidate media ownership much more than it already was consolidated over the past 20 years, and especially after the Telecommunications Act in 1996, which is how Clear Channel, for example, went from 12 stations to 1,200. And it's a very scary time. Ted Turner, interestingly enough, had a very interesting piece in the Washington Post a couple days ago talking about how CNN would never have been able to happen. How his entire broadcast empire would never have been able to happen under the rules that the FCC is now proposing to undertake, because it essentially gives a handful of large media conglomerates a monopoly and does not allow for innovation. It does not allow for small risk-taking entrepreneurs to come in. You know, just from a business standpoint, it's not a good idea. From a public policy standpoint, it allows large corporations that have a particular political viewpoint, such as Fox, to really exercise a monopoly on how we understand the world around us, what types of music we hear also. That's one of the big menaces of Clear Channel. And there has been this enormous grassroots movement that has really come up over the past several months. We saw that here in town with the public hearing that one of the commissioners, Michael Cobbs, held a couple months ago. That's saying this is a bad thing for democracy. And you pit that against the broadcast lobby, which is extremely powerful, the National Association of Broadcasters and those folks, and also the D.C. Court of Appeals, Clarence Thomas's old stomping ground, which has been throwing out a number of the FCC regulations around things like broadcast ownership, basically on the same sorts of grounds the campaign finance runs into problems, which is to say the idea that money is free speech and preventing people from buying things is trampling on their First Amendment rights. So it's that kind of a balancing act, and there are a lot of people who are very, very afraid of what's going to happen on Monday and the sort of, you know, gold rush mentality amongst the handful of very large corporations that may result. There's also some interest in Congress, I think, in trying to rein in the FCC if, in fact, it does take off a lot of the remaining barriers. And it really speaks to the need, and we talk about Eat the State every week because both Marie and I are involved with that, and we have this program, and there's the IMC in town, and Free Press and Real Change and all the other really good alternative media outlets in this city. We need in this city and this country to really be taking seriously the idea of alternative media, encouraging people to seek out other sources, and trying to find ways around the information barriers and the information monopolies that are being exercised, because that's what we may be facing come Monday.
All right. Well, speaking of people being afraid, there was a big fanfare and champagne flowing this week as Mr. Bush announced the new tax cuts.
Who's afraid exactly? I didn't quite follow that transition.
I would say about everybody on the receiving end of that, which would be, you know, 200 and some million Americans that aren't going to benefit from that.
I thought you meant that people were afraid that they wouldn't be able to, you know, buy their additional yachts and Lear jets before the supply ran out or something.
That's a possibility.
I want to talk a little bit about the tax cut, because it's come out now this week, just in the last couple of days, after people have actually had a chance to read through the bill. And you have to understand that a lot of these bills get passed without any of the senators and representatives voting on them having read the bill and really examining it before they take the final vote.
And that has been a hallmark of the Bush administration, is to try and prevent legislators from actually reading the final copy of the bill until just before the vote.
Yeah, and in this case, Bush had pressed really hard for a tax cut bill to be passed before the Memorial Day weekend, and so there was a lot of rushing at the very end to get something passed. And in this case, in the rush, a key provision got cut from the tax cut bill that would have provided the increase in the child care credit to everyone, including people who don't pay any tax. Now, I want to just describe for you for a minute what we're talking about here. When you have a tax cut that relies on a credit, what is called a tax credit, that's subtracted when you sit down and do your tax return. You subtract your exemptions and you subtract your deductions or your standard deduction, and you come up with your taxable income, right? Remember? And then from your taxable income, you calculate how much tax you owe, and then you subtract any tax credits from the tax you owe. The child care tax credit gets subtracted from any tax you owe. Now, if you're a family with children and you make less than $30,000, often you won't owe any tax at all after you've subtracted your exemptions, including you and your spouse and your children, and you subtract your deductions or your standard deduction. You often, if you're family and you make less than $30,000, you don't owe any tax at all, and so you can't take advantage of any of the tax credits, including tax credits that are meant for the very poorest of Americans, or these tax credits have been sold as part of a tax cut. Package is saying, well, this is going to benefit the poorest of the poor. Well, no, tax credits never benefit the poorest of the poor because the poorest of the poor don't pay tax. So tax credits are really a bogus form of aid to the poor. They don't really help the poor at all. They help middle class and upper middle class Americans. People who make between $30,000 and $110,000 can take advantage of the child tax credit, but people who make less than that will get nothing from it. And so there was a provision in the current tax package that would have changed that, that would have sent a $400 check to all Americans who make less than $110,000 a year, including people who don't owe any tax. And you might say, well, if they don't owe any tax, why would the government be giving them money? That's basically the Republican argument for cutting out this little provision in the tax cut bill. The answer to that is, do you want economic stimulus or don't you? If you want economic stimulus, you give money to the people who will spend it, and that's the poorest of the poor. They have to spend it because they always have bills and they always have necessities, and that's where the money goes. But if you don't care about economic stimulus, then you get rid of these little things that would provide money to the poorest of the poor. And that's where this tax plan really tells you what the tax cuts are for. They're for George Bush's main constituents, the richest of the rich.
Yeah, and it's also a bogus argument because the poor people do pay taxes. They don't necessarily pay federal income tax, but there are other sorts of ways in which all of us, you know, anybody who participates in the cash economy is paying any number of taxes up the wazoo, and most of those taxes are much more regressive than the federal income tax is, or the federal income tax was originally designed to be anyway. So when you say, well, you can't send these people $400, they don't pay income tax. No, they don't write a check on April 15th. But in fact, because so much of what they have to spend money on is in fact, you know, is a much higher percentage of the money that they bring in. In fact, it's often more than what they bring in. People go into debt. They're paying taxes on many of those expenditures, and they, you know, they have every right to get the money back, particularly because fewer and fewer government services directly benefit them. Many of the actual benefits of, you know, where our income taxes go right now are, you know, it's like this whole argument of rather than keeping money for ourselves, we'll transfer the wealth to the extremely wealthy and then hope that, you know, maybe they'll be feeling generous one afternoon and quote unquote create jobs, which is to say share some of our money that was originally taken from us and give some of that money and benefits back to us. You know, why not just give the money directly to us?
Well, and then even if the rich create jobs, poor people pay taxes more than just, for example, sales tax. They also pay taxes on their wages. They may or may not have income tax withhold, but they always pay Social Security and they always pay Medicare. Now, this bill was sold as why should dividends be taxed twice? That was one of the slogans for passing this bill. And I want to ask you, why not tax dividends twice? We tax wages three times. First, you have income taxes withheld, and then you have Social Security taxes withheld, and then you have Medicare taxes withheld. So poor people have their wages taxed at least twice, sometimes three times. Why not tax dividends twice?
That's a darn good question.
We'll leave that as the rhetorical question
right.
to ponder for the
let's,
week.
Let's
well, people
we'll
can
expect
be
some
thinking about
week.
That the next time their legislator comes to talk to them, they can say, Why not tax dividends twice? And, what were you thinking?
And, you know, it's interesting over the past 20, 25 years that some of these ideas have moved from being economically considered simply preposterous, what Bush Sr. once famously called voodoo economics, and, you know, have repeatedly been shown to not work at what they claim to do, which is to stimulate the economy and create jobs and so forth. No serious economist, I think, takes who doesn't already think they know the answer going in, can look at the numbers and say that holds water, and yet we continue to have that taken as not just a viable public policy option, but by many people as the gospel truth. And it's very interesting to see how that shift has occurred, because it really has nothing to do with the reality of how those policies have worked.
Yeah, and I think it's because people think about money. They think about making money, but they don't think about what their money actually does and where it goes and what they have to do when they pay taxes. People are just not used to thinking about the economy or talking about the economy or talking about their money. And I think that needs to change. I think people need to be talking more about how the whole money flow system works so that people begin to think about it, begin to understand it a little better. And then they can ask real serious questions instead of just accepting what so-called experts say.
Well, it's reinforced by these pseudo-experts that come on and tell them, you know, that the economy is something that's too complex for them to deal with. And mm-hmm. just yeah. listen to
and
our,
that's
our
not
economist.
True.
And
yeah. Anybody can understand
it. And as with many other fields like that, creating a whole vocabulary that is utter gibberish to most people mm-hmm. and when it's not that complex really
and nobody
to figure
out. Nobody sits down and says, well, you know, what the heck is a derivative? Well, it's just a way to gamble. Nobody actually sits down and explains it in terms you can understand.
Yeah. All right. Well,
let's move on.
Let's move on. Talk about the economic situation a little closer to home. Governor Gary Locke appears to be getting sweet with Boeing. Or
yeah. Speaking of gambling.
Yeah. Gambling on a losing proposition. Well, it's interesting that, you know, the legislature here in the state is still working on the budget, hammering away at it. They're trying to find enough things to cut so that they can fit in under this no new taxes mandate that the governor slapped on them and that the Republicans have taken up as their glorious banner.
The other
Republicans, yes. and the Democrats have been laboring under that and not standing up to the Republicans. Governor Locke went to the legislature and said, hey, I want $16 million more. What does he want it for? He wants it for a new port and rail facility in Everett, mostly for Boeing. And that money is to expand the Everett port so that larger containers can come in and be shipped to Boeing facilities. And what are going to be in those larger containers? Larger pieces of jets that will be assembled in Japan so that they can be more quickly assembled here. In other words, Boeing wants to ship jobs overseas. In the meantime, Governor Locke and our two Democratic senators are trying as hard as they can to get the new 787 plant located here in Washington State. And they don't have a prayer, but they're still spending all their time and energy on it when Governor Locke should be standing in Olympia and trying to get a budget passed as quickly as possible, and one that's a bit more fair than what's going to be coming out. Right now, he's asking for $16 million more out of that budget for Boeing, while the legislature is sitting there trying to figure out how far they can cut the voter mandated payroll increases for the state's teachers, which shouldn't even be on the table. I mean, the voters passed an initiative saying you got to give these teachers raises and you got to cut class size, and the legislature's sitting there trying to figure out how much they can do and how little they can do before risking voter wrath over this issue.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I mean, when Tim Iman gets an initiative passed, the legislature, you know, salutes and doesn't dare touch
even
it.
Even when it's not constitutional.
Even when it's not constitutional, and even when it makes no fiscal sense as public policy whatsoever. You know, the thing that is amazing to me about these giveaways to Boeing, and, you know, it's just the steady drumbeat of them. Politicians and, you know, newspaper editorialists and people like that in this state seem to be the last people to realize that Boeing is no longer this cute little hometown company. It is an international conglomerate that has made a abundantly clear over the past number of years that, number one, it feels no loyalty to this city, to this region, to this state. Number two, it is going to do everything possible to ship jobs overseas,
and
outsource
to
wherever possible, minimize its labor costs, and that includes breaking the union wherever it can. And number three, that because it is seeking out the lowest possible wages for its workforce, it is not going to ship new jobs to Washington State, to the Seattle or Puget Sound region. It is not going to create new facilities here. It is going to do whatever is possible to move as many of those jobs out as possible. And, you know, you can talk all you want about creating a competitive business climate and improving the transportation system so that poor trucks from Boeing don't have to sit in traffic for an extra half hour, you know, whatever it is. And there are a number of good economic reasons for being concerned about those issues, but saving Boeing jobs is not one of them, because Boeing ain't staying around. It's just not. And
that's their policy.
And
it's
that's
not
their,
based on anything that we do or don't do.
Yeah,
that's
and they have
policy.
Been very, very clear about that. They've been as clear as they could possibly you would ever expect a corporation to be. And yet you have people like Gary Locke running around taking $16 million extraordinarily scarce dollars that could be used for things like teachers or parks or healthcare or, you know, any number of other things that money is not going to get spent on. And instead, it's corporate money flushed down the toilet.
And Maria, weren't you saying that Monday was a significant day?
Yeah, Monday's a significant day for the legislature because they're still working on the budget. But Monday is when the state releases its income forecasts for the next year or two, when we're going to find that the income forecasts are going down and that the state legislature, with a smaller income forecast, may have to start over at the very beginning again, hammering out a new budget with a much smaller framework.
All right.
Now, why? I mean, fortunately, we have an in-studio expert here. If you can explain to me why it is that, you know, what is it, every quarter that they release these income forecasts, mm-hmm. the state does?
Yeah. Those, last quarter it went down.
Well, it is. That's what I was going to ask. It has gone down virtually every quarter for the last 2 years. Why do they keep overestimating what the future revenue is going to
be
for Washington State? Is the economy just keep getting worse?
No, it's because the economy is still kind of in a hovering position, and they had expected the economy to pick up, and it hasn't. And it's partly because of all the happy talk that you get from economists all over the nation. They're always, oh, it's going to pick up next month. Oh, consumer spending's going to revive. Oh, this tax cut's going to help. You know, you keep getting this happy talk. And so the guys who do economic forecasts in the state are looking at, well, what's a reasonable expectation for the economic upturn that we're expecting? And they do a conservative, you know, they look at what various economists have predicted. It's going to do an upturn by 3%. It's going to go up 5%. And they try to figure out what a moderate or a conservative upturn is going to be. And that's what they use as their forecast. That's what they use as their for the budget. But then the economic forecasts come out and say, well, it hasn't been picking up and it's less than they expected. So in part, it's the divorce between between the happy talk that's supposed to drive the economy and make people spend more money and invest more, et cetera, and the actual numbers when they really look at what the economy has done in the last 2 to 3 months and what they think it's going to do in the next 2 to 3 months and next 2 to 3 years.
All right, so happy talk is driving the economy. That's great.
No, no, happy talk is providing the expectations that we can't meet.
Yeah, it's fooling us into spending the money that drives the economy. That's
all right. Well, we got 5 minutes left. We're not going to be able to cover everything we had planned. You can have your choice of talking about the Congo or Aceh.
Let's talk about those two. Jav, you go with Aceh first.
I do very briefly, because we don't have time. I wrote a column about it that's up on Working for... No, I'm going to go up Monday, I'm sorry, on Working for Change. But Aceh is a province in Indonesia. The Indonesian military, which, as we've talked about on this program, has not been held accountable at all for its crimes against humanity.
One
in
of
East
the
Timor.
Worst militaries in the
yeah,
world.
Yeah, and I mean, they have a track record of multiple genocides in the last half century. And many of those people are still running the Indonesian military, and they have now invaded Aceh province, where there is a a 25-year-old sort of low-grade separatist movement that the Indonesian government has vowed they will stamp out within 6 months. Actually, in the last couple of days, they've acknowledged that they can never stamp it out. But there is a steady stream of reports coming out from Aceh province of villages where the military is going in and simply massacring people. It's very, very scary stuff. The Indonesian military is historically very close to the United States and the United States military and government.
And to Britain as well. Which provides Britain now provides a lot of their weapon sales.
Yeah, there's actually a ban on weapon sales to the Indonesian military that is still in place because of East Timor. East Timor had its first anniversary of independence last week. The Bush administration, since East Timor's independence, has been pressing for a lift on the ban of both U.S. military training and advisors and also weapon sales. And the U.S. still has a lot of influence on what the Indonesian military could do there. We're hearing nothing about it at all.
Okay, in the meantime, in Congo, Congo's been going through a civil war for 5 years now. It's a regional conflict. There have been troops from Uganda and Rwanda and Angola and Zimbabwe and several other neighboring countries fighting and providing support to the various factions in the Congo. And it's taken 5 to 6 years for the UN to broker some kind of a peace deal, and they're struggling towards peace. But right now in the eastern Congo, Uganda has pulled out its troops and left two heavily armed militias, one militia armed by Uganda and the other militia armed by Rwanda, to local tribal groups that have been very heavily armed, are now fighting over a town called Bunia in eastern Congo. And so far, around 400 to 500 people have been massacred, most of them civilians, in the fighting. And there are only about 700 UN peacekeeping troops there. And Kofi Annan, in the last couple of weeks, has begged the UN Security Council to do something, to send some troops there to try and stop these two militias from fighting and to try to disarm them and to make this peace deal work. And so far, Britain has provided troops, and France and Germany and Italy and Spain. And guess what? The U.S. has provided no troops for the peacekeeping effort in the Congo. And this kind of thing and what's going on in Aceh really proves to the world that the U.S. only cares when our economic interest is at stake, particularly when we can grab the resources of a country like Iraq, when we can have control of their oil. But we don't care when it comes to the massacre of civilians in Aceh province in Indonesia at the hands of probably the bloodiest military in the world.
Oh, and where ExxonMobil also has a number of facilities.
Yeah, and where ExxonMobil actually is benefiting from repression by the Indonesian military. Nor do they care when it comes to fighting in the Congo that has been raging for 5 years and is probably the most destructive conflict on that continent.
Yeah, 2 to 3 million people over the past 5 years have died.
That's right.
All right. Well, almost out of time. Quickly, maybe we can mention a couple events that are happening this weekend. One, tonight, Weapons of Mass Distraction happening. It's a mix of support for local alternative media, mix of music and people talking about alternative media, myself included, for 10 whole minutes.
Yeah, just like talked about with the FCC coming up this week. We need to support these folks.
And where's that happening, Mike?
That is happening at a place called Segway, which is in Ballard at 5710 22nd Northwest. There is a fee at the door, but it gets you into some beer and food and some good entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as there is the talked about 7:30, the conference by the People of Color Against War at Home and Abroad, which is happening at the Labor Temple today from 11 to 5. And
The Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit will be in town for the next several days, starting tomorrow. And there'll be a number of protests and events around that. The city also has, as of Thursday evening, tried to demand that organizers put forward liability insurance, which is an unheard of and very scary demand. So keep an eye on that. There's an event at Town Hall tomorrow night, and the big protest, as I understand it, will be at Westlake on Monday evening at 6:30.
All right. So with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where can they find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, and other places where you find free periodicals around town. You can find us on the web at www.eatthestate. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, or you want to just rave and rant at us, you can call our voicemail line at 206. Oh, I forgot. 903-9461. I almost forgot the number.
There you go. And so is that paper found in these different places on what is known as the periodical table? Never mind.
All right, forget
that. We're going to get thrown out of the studio now. So
initials are EA.